And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 23rd, 2020. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I am very excited for our discussion today. It's one of my favorite topics. We're going to be talking about word choice and how it can affect climate communications. So tune in.
So Mariah, words matter. I think we were taught, I was always taught, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me, right? But there is a level at which words frame our conversation, frame the vocabulary we use, frames how we think about things. And the people who get to define the terms often get to define the entire debate, right? Our conversation. And that is certainly true in the realm of climate change. And it comes up recently in an article published in the New Yorker by someone with the last name Whittacombe.
Yeah, Lizzie Whittacombe.
Lizzie Whittacombe. Great name, by the way.
I know.
And the title of the article is, How should the media cover climate change? Right? So, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And the story that's told inside it's a story. It's a narrative. It's a personal journey of a scholar, a Renaissance scholar, who made the trajectory from Renaissance literature to realizing that her skills were better applied thinking about climate change and recognizing that the way the media talked about climate change was in its own form of denial. Right? Is that am I getting the article so far correct, Mariah?
Yeah, I mean, rather the way the media didn't talk about climate change was the denial, right? This scholar Genevieve Gunter started the group In Climate Silence, notably about how so often disasters were being covered with no mention of climate change, and that is, in her words, just as pernicious as denial. When you have a climate disaster and you make no mention of climate change, it is doing a complete disservice to that disaster. And so
it leaves people thinking that it's random and an event from God, and that this is just the way it happened, and there's no deeper explanation, right?
Right.
No mention it.
When we know the deeper explanation and we know how to start solving that. Mm-hmm. So not making a mention of that. And I think for a long time, the backstory here is that until 2019, the media never covered climate change, right? It was mentioned 4% of any of the news coverage. I mean, whenever you had these big extreme weather events, it just wasn't mentioned. And that's because it was a ratings killer. Yeah.
Unprecedented,
yeah.
And I think the article is not so colorful as to say Voldemort, but basically that the argument that broadcasters in both newspaper and TV are afraid of the backlash, right? Backlash that can't say this word or else you get a whole lot of nasty emails, right? And that. Is that a brave journalistic stance, I suppose?
But just to bring it back, is that now they're talking about it, right? So now you do have the media talking about it, which is wonderful. It's fantastic. Yay, media, finally, right? And I mean, it's really been the past year, and even more so just the past couple of months, where we've really started to see it being addressed regularly, comprehensively, using the words we need to hear about it's a crisis, it's an emergency, and this is what it looks like.
Do you have a sense? I don't think it's in the article, but I mean, what broke? What literal dam broke? Because I think we've been on this show wondering, what is the thing that will finally wake people up? Right? But somehow the combination of the wildfires in California and the hurricanes in the Southwest, somehow there's been some, I don't know, this awakening, right?
Who knows, too, if some part of it is people are seeing the denial associated with the science around COVID and maybe starting to say, interesting. Okay, wow, we're seeing firsthand how science denial is detrimental to our life as we know it. And so maybe there's some dots being connected. I mean, I think you're right. It's certainly the natural disasters are really the wake-up call. I mean, you know, a size of California, a chunk of California the size of the state of Connecticut has burned, right? I mean, the size of an entire state has burned in California. And I was just listening to a story about how there's one of the Cal Fire chiefs is saying there's no end in sight. This is going to keep going all the way through the end of the year. And again, it's unprecedented. Well, no, it's climate change. You know, I mean,
I think I agree with you. I think you made a good point that the obvious lies, the way I would put it, is the obvious lies coming out of the White House about COVID in tandem with the statements about climate change. It seems like the administration has so completely forfeited any claim to truth, right, that people do begin to connect the dots and look and say, well, wait a minute, if they're so backwards about mask wearing, right, and how to deal with it, you know, and I see the evidence of my eyes out on TV, three hurricanes coming into New Orleans. Say, well, wait, okay, maybe it is the COVID. And we're back to COVID being the milestone, watershed, turning point for lots and lots of things, right?
Right. Science. Maybe science does matter. Maybe science is believable. Yeah. You know, maybe you've got Anthony Fauci. You have all the CDC scientists who are doing their best to keep this contained. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, scientists do know what they're talking about, you know?
Well, I mean, you couldn't ignore the suppression of science when the president is on TV every night talking about injecting cleanser in his body, right? Everyone saw that. You say, well, wait a minute, maybe he's not right about that science. And yeah, as you say, that doubt begins to creep across the... one of the... In the article, Genevieve Gunter... they talk about some of the words that they object to. I'm trying to find my list of those because I copied them out.
Yeah, I have one. I mean, one of the things she mentions is she takes sort of umbrage with the word uncertainty. And so she's writing, I don't know if the book is out. It's if it is, I'm certainly very interested in it. But she's writing a book about some of the words she'd rather see used. And so a lot of the climate denial machine has glommed onto the word uncertainty, because in scientific research, there's a measure of uncertainty. And she said, no, wait, let's not call it a measure of uncertainty, because that, you know, when you're talking about uncertainty in science, you're talking about the very tail end of that statistical curve. And really what it is that you are 95% confident that your data are correct. But there's a 5% uncertainty. And she's like, why don't we talk about it in terms of the confidence, you know, that we have that 95% confidence in the data.
And I know that in so my field, at least originally, was high energy physics. And there they talked all the time about the confidence level. You have a 95% confidence level that this is true. And certainly in the IPCC documents, they've gone to specifically defined words that are associated with a numerical, right? We're 95% confident means we're confident. We're 97% confident means we're really confident. 99% is we're really, really, really good. And they've thought all that through. But I mean, I guess I would just want to point out that the words in science of uncertainty and error have so there's an error on your measurement, right? And if you're not a scientist or you want to exploit that, if someone says error, that means the answer is wrong, right? That's by definition. But uncertainty and error, which are pretty much the same thing, are mathematically defined quantities that say how much your answer, even though, as you say, you're 95% confident it is X, the uncertainty tells you, we have a 10% chance that it could be X plus 0.1, and we have a 10% chance it could be X minus 0.1, and that's the uncertainty. But it's not as if the result is uncertain, because that's a very language interpretation of the word uncertain or error, right? And the scientists have very precise things. So I think she's right. Finding a way to stop talking about the uncertainty level, because that just gives people a deep sigh of relief to say, well, the scientist's uncertain, you know, let's go back and have another Narragansett somewhere.
Right. I think that's a good point. Go ahead. Yeah.
The other word that she was not happy with is the use of scientific consensus.
Yeah. Right?
And can you quote what she said about consensus sounds like?
Yeah. You know, I think she feels, she wrote that when you talk about having a consensus, it's sort of like, well, yeah, we sat around and we had some discussions and we were like, yeah, this sounds bright. We all came to the same consensus on this. This sounds like a good answer. Climate change is real and it's anthropogenic and, you know, caused by humans and so on and so forth. And she's like, it's not a consensus. This is knowledge that everybody agrees on. These are, you know, research that's been reviewed. It's data that have been collected. It's knowledge. And so it's not like a discussion, a happy discussion over the Narragansett, as you mentioned, Narragansett beer, right? As you mentioned, no, this is a knowledge base that is shared by all of the researcher entities out there.
Right. And you can have people who have never met each other in different countries, different time zones, all enjoying the same consensus, because you're right. The consensus is based on what gets published. What are people studying? Right. What are the reviewers for an article? Are they accepting this sort of thought? Can the information be reproduced? So, yeah. So you're quite right. It's not a backroom thing where they take a vote and say, oh, yeah, we all agree that this is the consensus. It's just this is what emerges from the literature. And this is what people are studying. So I think the Oreskes article, they talk about 97% consensus. It's not like they had a vote of 100 people that all said 97 said yes and 3 said no. It's just that the work that everyone's doing 97% of the time is around the science that's generally regarded as legitimate climate science. And only 3% of the time are people off studying chemtrails or something. Right.
And it goes back to, you know, I love this analogy of like, well, if 97% of dentists that you saw told you you should pull the tooth and only 3% told you you shouldn't, well, you'd probably pull the tooth.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. So I think that the reason it's good to have the discussion is because these things pop up fairly frequently. If you're at all attempting to educate yourself about climate issues, you're going to see numbers about the uncertainty in the reading, how the uncertainty changed, and the consensus, scientific consensus, blah, blah, blah. And you need to understand that these are well thought out, meaningful things that are not in fact used in scientific language the same way they are in lay language. Right?
Yeah.
But I guess, go ahead.
Well, of course, she had one other big one, I think, to me, which was this idea of we need to stop the climate problem and we created the climate problem. And it's not we, it's a small handful of corporations that are polluting, that are pumping carbon dioxide emissions into the air. That's the problem. It's not you and I. It is, except in our omissions of maybe not talking about climate change enough, or not, you know, being active enough. It's against the companies that are polluting the air, but I think that's a pretty significant one too.
Absolutely. The concept of, what is it, Bill Clinton and Bill Barr talking about, what's the definition of is, what does we mean? You colloquially, you would say we means everybody. I have two legs, two arms, two eyes. You know, I'm a human, so I'm part of the we. When in fact, the we that are doing this bad stuff tend to be a small, select group of people who are way ahead of the curve of everyone else. I mean, I guess I don't have the specifics in front of me, but it's like the 1% in the United States have some enormous preponderance of the carbon emissions. Right, because they're on the jets. They're the ones with the lifestyle and the Hummer and all that kind of stuff.
Well, is it the one? It's, I don't know. Is it the 1%? Or I think it's like just a handful of corporations, right? It's like 20 corporations.
Again, that's back to who is the we, I think we did a show about, you know, who's making the decision that commits us to burning the carbon fuels instead of putting up solar panels. And that's the designer way back who made the power plant. So just to go completely off into left field for one second, same thing is true right now. I guess the Mass Pike repair, right? We talked about a few weeks ago where they were trying to put the train and the Mass Pike and Soldiers Field Road and everything right through that little 200-foot section. So what's I've seen popped up on Twitter is, just take out Soldiers Field Road and you have room for everything, right? So now you don't have Soldiers. But I mean, the point is that decision is what's going to lock everyone into their carbon emissions from their car for the next 30 years. Yeah. So it comes back to who's the we making the decision about how we're going to pollute the planet, right?
Right. Yeah. I think the other thing she sort of says about it is that it, not to think of it as something we are doing, but as something we are prevented from undoing, which is kind of an interesting sort of spin on it too.
Well, it's like if the we is making all the decisions, the rest of us are sitting around watching them, right? So we're being prevented from doing what we would want to do.
It'd be lovely to just be driving electric vehicles or to have some sort of great, you know, easy multi people can transport fast and, you know,
that's right.
High speed rail, light to light rails, whatever they are. So yeah. So, you know, there's also a couple words too that I think, I think this talking about the science, there's certain words you can use. And I watched in a video about Sunday morning, it's something I've known about a lot from Frameworks Institute, is the idea of not saying greenhouse gas emissions, instead saying a heat trapping blanket. Or actually one of the announcers said like a dog in a car with all the windows up on a hot summer day, right? Those are something that you can kind of wrap your mind around a little bit better. So,
I've seen things that talk about carbon pollution, right? Which carbon dioxide, you know, you breathe it out, I mean, all those kinds of things. The carbon dioxide is in your fizzy water, right? So is it pollution? But if you frame what you're coming out of your tailpipe as pollution, that's another choice of words that defines the discussion.
Yeah, or even saying regular versus rampant carbon pollution, right? Regular carbon emissions are okay, but when you have rampant, meaning way too many, that's when you're going to have the problems. So, like you said at the top of the show, words matter.
So, dear listener, choose your words carefully. Always be thoughtful about what you're saying, and I guess in particular, what someone else is saying to you. Because 90% of the time, when you see that the American Institute of Petroleum ad on TV, you know they're not telling you the truth. Whenever you see an Exxon commercial talking about how that green algae is going to save us all, don't believe it. All right, Mariah, what we'll do is we'll put up a link to the article, very interesting article about word choices, and that's at the New Yorker, and we'll put it in the blog, which will be at www.massclimateaction.org/blog. If you want to tell us your favorite words, for good or ill, right? If you have a word that you think needs to be used less or needs to be used more, send us a definition, and please use it in a sentence. Send that to podcast@massclimateaction.net. We read all our email, and we enjoy getting it. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher, as you probably are. So please tell your friends to listen to this show on their favorite streaming app. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support, which keeps us aware of the horizon week after week. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our action, for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of those things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, do you agree with all those words? All those funny little words I slipped in there to sort of, I think I got
important ones. A lot of important words there.
Anyway, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.